should you know that should be coming that's not here at this moment?
Somebody did say they were going to call in.
Probably Dave Dyes. Mm-hmm. Donald
Porter. Maybe he was going
to call in. Okay.
It's as slack as beat now here at Sink.
Yeah. I think
where's Lynn?
Pardon me?
Lynn, where's she?
Lynn at? Had her brother was hospitalized, yeah, and she was taking him from the hospital today, I believe.
Bringing him home?
Bringing him home, as I understood it. She was not able to attend. He had some kind of sudden illness. Pardon me?
He got burnt.
He got burnt, that's correct. Yes, you're right. 40% of his body, apparently.
Yeah, they was working on the engine and it backfired, I think. Caught him a fire.
Was it there at the shipyard?
No, he did right on the rebuild down there working on a boat.
They were working on a boat, okay.
They were working on a boat.
A burn is a tough injury. Mm-hmm.
So he took a can of ether.
Oh, no.
Okay.
And sprayed it. And when it went, it didn't start, it backfired and it blowed it all on him.
On him, all his
family. And it wouldn't be allergic. It had rolled him in dirt and everything.
Right.
And
all
I
right.
think it burned his burning bad.
So,
all his face, neck, everything.
The phone is on. I don't know if anybody is on it.
Shall we? Donnie Porter had asked to do a call in, so we'll see if we can get him.
Okay.
If not, if we don't hear him click in a minute,
okay.
We may just try and call him.
That's no problem. Is everybody all right with that?
Yeah. Yeah, that's only five. Now, the only thing is, I mean, we were just trying to get ahead of next year's discussions, really. So everything on there is a discussion. We're not necessarily looking for...
There's no action to be taken. No.
Even if we don't end up with a quorum, which even with Don, we won't, we can still move forward with any
discussion.
Give an informed discussion item to the commission without a quorum. So,
okay.
And in fact, I don't have a whole lot for you guys. We'll see with each of these items. I just have one or two slides on it.
Okay. Well, maybe some of the members will have some input on the agenda items as well.
I might give him a call and just if he's even attempted to call.
Well, Joe, do you think we could go forward with introductions, announcements, the first part of the agenda then?
Yes.
I think that would probably be worth doing. So I thought with introductions, I don't know how you normally do it here, but it would be my intuition to start from left to right and make sure everybody knows who each other is and where they're from and their name, where they're from, and what they do.
I think that's a great idea.
Would you like to start, sir?
I'm Wayne Morris. I'm from the Northern Neck. I'm just Crab Potter.
You're Crab Potter?
Beal Potter.
Okay.
I'm Viola West from Gloucester. I have a picking house, and my husband's a crabber.
Ed Tankard. I'm from Eastern Shore, Exmoor, and I'm on the commission.
Yeah, I'm Mark Sanford, a crabber. I live on the Eastern Shore, but I crab out of Lynn Haven.
I'm Ronnie George, and I'm a crabber.
Chris Moore, fishery scientist for Chesapeake Bay Foundation.
I think that's a great idea to do that, Mr. Tankard. It's, in fact, several of the members here tonight are newer members that just started last year. I think, Chris, you might be our longest-standing member.
Man, that's good.
And, Joe, tell us again your part here with VMRC or just on a daily basis and perhaps today as well.
Sure. Well, today. I'm just sort of running around today. It's a big chunk of fisheries management staff sits within the plans and statistics department, and I've been the head of the department since we kind of rearranged things in 2012 when Jack moved up to be the commissioner, and Rob became the chief of fisheries. We don't really have a crab division like we have an oyster division, so it's really a lot of different staff members that pitch in at different times. We are currently without a deputy chief, and Joe Grist, who was our deputy chief, was very involved in the crab management stuff and led us through all these bushel limits that we've had in place for a few years and some of the sanctuary stuff as well. So right now, with a little bit of that, I'm you know, going to be trying to fill some shoes there. But really, crabs are something that all – just about everybody in fisheries management staff is dealing with. And I guess, you know, the other introduction.
yes.
We have two new staff members. Jill Ramsey is one of our planners, and, you know, they get a rotating task of getting stuck with minutes on top of working up data here. And Katie Mae Lohman also just started with us, and she's actually on third floor working directly for Rob.
Okay.
And Ron is one of the other longstanding members here, so Ron, if you want to pick it up.
Ron Lips, he's a professor of marine science at DIMS and the head of the crustacean ecology program.
Great. All right. Well, and therefore, as we go through, any announcements that you want to make as we begin the meeting?
I think really all I wanted to put out there tonight was that this is just kind of an open forum, and I think we're not necessarily looking for any decisions that have to be made or anything to be voted on, and we're lucky in that case since we don't have a quorum, that I think if they're moving along on one of these items and we wanted to stay focused on that, there's no reason why we couldn't do that. We do have Ida Hall here tonight, a member of the Potomac River Fisheries Commission, who is going to give a presentation on the crab pot buoy tagging that they do there. So we will want to squeeze that in. But as far as the first two items,
okay,
it's really just open to the committee for thought.
All right. Do you want to try to contact?
Yeah, I would like to give. We may have had an issue there, so I would like to.
So why does that? Joel, want to take a look at the minutes from last meeting and see if they kind of reflect what happened?
And then from there, you should also have a handout if you want to go over to take a quick look at this
right
history of the sanctuary.
Gotcha.
disquiet me.
Well, we can feel free to. Do you see anything in here that didn't sound like what happened on the minutes? Sound accurate? And Jill, did we decide we had a quorum or we do not have a quorum?
I think that you said you did not.
You're not, okay.
No, I don't think we did.
Okay, so we won't ask for any approval of the minutes. Thought of keeping the season, some discourse going. What have you all thought of the crab season thus far?
It's pretty good.
It's been good. For
it's
us.
Been good.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And the market price has held up?
No.
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 Recently
they haven't.
Yeah. 2 minutes.
2 minutes.
2 minutes.
Okay. Well, since we can't really approve the minutes without a quorum, I guess we'll continue on past that and go to discussion item. Discussion item number A, modification to the blue crab sanctuary areas.
Yeah, and so as pull up the map in a minute, but I think, you know, a lot of you are probably familiar with what we call the 1942 sanctuary that's been in the Code of Virginia. And, you know, after that, it's really been a fairly recent history of changes to the blue crab sanctuary. And this committee spent quite a bit of time on some potential changes over the last year. And we did make one commission decision that was kind of a change from what CMAQ started out with these rolling closures last year. So you see here that what we had in place since 2011, when we were actually able to change the code and get all areas open and closed on the same date, which was May 16. And it's a busy slide. Huh? Does it fit in there? It doesn't fit in there all that well. Shoot that down a bit. Okay, sorry about that. We're gonna.
Sure.
I think the most important thing there is the only thing we lost is the front end of that. But we can see right now that we have by the color code we've got three separate areas with three separate dates where the sanctuary kicks in.
Right.
And so as far as this being a discussion item, you know, we spent a lot of time on not only considerations to time of year, but also areas. And that was something, after looking at what potential reductions were that we were able to show, was something that more or less, you know, the committee moved away from. It didn't, at that time, just as a reminder, it didn't seem that for the amount of area that would come back into play that it was necessarily worth making that adjustment. But
Joe, just one note in looking at this. This is very helpful, the bulleted list. Area 4, though, I don't think on the bulleted list we actually have when it closed. And I think it was 2008, 2009 time frame. It would just be helpful to possibly add that in for a
few. Yeah. Was there a handout, Joe?
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah, I didn't get that. Sorry. I'm just missing.
You knew
one. So, sorry.
No, that's a good point. That was when.
And maybe it was as early as 2007, but. Maybe that's what is April 2007 is. Oh, Area 4. Never mind. I completely missed it. It's on here. I was reading it differently. Sorry.
I thought it actually occurred before then, but. I've got a question about this map. It seems to me like you've got an Area 3 now in the kind of the pumpkin color. Why?
No, that's not been now. This is actually been now.
Okay. Yeah. Why is that area separated though, I guess is my real question. I thought originally the area would go from Smith Island Light all the way to the Carolina line. It wasn't actually broke up by Cape Henry Light. Do you follow where I'm coming from? All that was considered one area at one time. The coastal area, I guess.
Yeah.
So maybe maybe it might have to do with the fact that
it actually came in after. It was an addition, if you remember. We actually did the lower seaside closure as its own area first, and then it was an addition.
Okay. So that's always been there. It's just...
Yeah. It just got wrapped in, and I think really it was a factor of it was the easiest way to establish it.
Yeah.
Was to make the extension. And that was for additional savings in 2008.
Do you actually have a description of the Area 4, the boundaries? And the reason I ask that, I mean... Down the road, you know, you know as well as I do that I've been kind of pushing for an area off of Virginia Beach to go. And the way that I'm looking at that is basically I'm assuming it's at the Cape Henry Light in an easterly direction. And that wasn't the description that I wanted. I wanted to go basically to the north and then out to the 30-foot curve and around is how I wanted it to be, you know. So I'm thinking, you know, that might be an issue down the road.
Mm-hmm. But I think the description as it is now is from Cape Henry Light eastward to the 3 mile. You know, it's all state waters.
Right, I know that, but I don't. That
you
goes back.
You need for a cutout.
Right. I just don't ever remember seeing that as a cutout. You know, the mouth of the bay as a separate line, and that's where I'm thinking it may be an issue down the road.
I see.
You know, I think this was something that was added. You know.
Mm-hmm.
If you understand where I'm getting at.
I do. Yeah. Well, and I mean, that might be something for discussion tonight.
Right.
Is that seaside, you weren't at the meeting, but you did follow up. You did hear some of that. You listened to the discussion.
Oh, no, I was at the meeting.
You were at that one?
Yeah. It was three of us from the Lynn Haven area, and that we all stood up and spoke. And, but again, you know. Anyway, moving on. That's all I have to say. I just, you know.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest with you, it was. I guess almost the flip side, it seemed like there was so much concern for possible interactions between crab pots and recreational people.
Right, and I had even spoke to an individual who was representing the city of Virginia Beach, and they told me point blank that there were no objections to our request. Mm. You know, so I mean, we were kind of stunned, especially since this whole CMAC panel pretty much voted in favor of having that area open. You know, just
and again, the area is the depicted as the light green.
It's the
we wrote it as a
yeah
a cutout. It was a cutout.
Yeah, my description, I think maybe when Joe took it down, it was just a basically to 45th Street in Virginia Beach. We'd go to that from Cape Henry Light around. Henry Light. And the reason why we wanted that is because the historical sanctuary on the Virginia Beach side goes all the way to the shoreline. So in the summer months, we have no place to go except inside Lynn Haven River.
Right.
Which is a highly congested area.
Sure.
You know, and there's been occasions where people have basically complained to the VMRC about being closer to dock and stuff like that. So what we were trying to do is alleviate some of the pressure in the river itself and, you know, possibly accommodating some of the citizens also in Virginia Beach. So that was the whole gist of it.
And so last year when we were discussing these new boundaries, it was something that CMAQ voted on as I said, if you look at I'll use the green even though this was the oldest, to just kind of add an exemption that this, you know, small area in here, they would be allowed to set pots. And that was voted on to bring forward to the commission. And really, you know, as far as fishery staff, they, we didn't have any concerns with that. It became some of the commission members, and then I think there were some constituents that spoke to them about beachgoers and boats that are going through there, and that there, you know, right. That there would be gear conflicts.
I mean, and this is an area that we previously worked for years and years and years.
Right.
Just a small number of people.
Yeah,
and we were able to show that there were only a few people out there, you know, lost that area.
Yeah, it was basically at the height of it, it was probably maybe six people that actually crabbed in that area.
Really?
Yeah. And now, honestly, there will be three people
that
would be capable of going there. So.
I don't understand the user conflict, to be honest with you.
Well, there really isn't because, I mean, the reality of it is the fact that when we crab down there, we have to crab outside of the surf zone, and that's quite a ways off the beach there. So we're not interacting with swimmers or anything like that. The concern was that we actually wanted to go beyond the fishing pier. They didn't fully understand that, thinking that we would be in the way of the charter boats or the sightseeing boats that may be there. And I quickly addressed that to I forget the fellow's name. It's Dan something that works for the city of Virginia Beach. I talked to him and discussed that, you know, what we wanted exactly. And he said, well, I don't have a problem with this. And again, like I said, I don't think y'all received any kind of protest or any kind of concern about that.
I mean, we had some calls, but
nobody followed up.
But when we ended up at the meeting, there weren't any.
Right.
There was no actual public comment against it.
Correct.
It was just the commission.
Right.
That they had heard enough, you know, in between meetings.
Right.
That they still.
I think one of the commissioners I think was concerned with interactions, like you said, which, you know, it's that would not happen, you know, based on the church space and stuff like that.
Is there anything that we need to do as a committee to kind of take this on, or?
I mean, I don't think that there's really any, and I mean, Ron, I mean, that was something that we had talked about as well, and there, you know, we didn't even see that there needed to be any necessary trade-off, so it was something that it could come back as an agenda item, maybe with some footwork, you know, at that level,
right.
You know, that
you know, I thought
Virginia Beach really understood that.
Right. And I thought that, you know, the guy I talked to, I can't remember his last name, because his first name was Dan, I know that.
Uh-huh.
And I explained to him and everything like that. And, you know, they said, no, we don't have a problem. So,
And by the areas, you know, some of these areas are actually open to for recreation.
Sure.
Correct. Correct.
Yeah.
So there could still be gear in the water anyways.
Right.
Well, should we put that on the agenda for our next meeting? Some type of vote again on our behalf?
Yeah, that can be one of the, you know, that can certainly be one of the sanctuary items to come back for a vote. I think Mark is right, you know, that congestion in Lynn Haven now is just...
immense.
Is one of the things that, you know,
it is.
And of course, especially this past year, we've gotten, you know, a lot of talk about what's going on around the concrete chips and kits.
Right.
So the two areas where, you know, there's a lot of talk about, there's just congestion and
it's hard to navigate a boat around the country.
Right, and of course that would be if I had to leave.
You have a good sized boat.
And of course, if I had to leave Lynnhaven, I'd go right back to the concrete ships. You know, so I'd be causing more congestion there. You know.
Yeah.
So. Is this a conversation just about, you know, the specific sanctuary off Virginia Beach, or kind of going to
general. It's just modifications being, you know, is this the final product? What
right.
we ended up with in
yeah.
the first 2015, or are there continued discussions on?
Well, this is just a discussion. I mean, how do y'all feel about, you know, the rotating type dates? I mean, is everybody good with that?
It worked better up north for us.
I'm sorry, excuse me?
I say the number one area will be a lot better up north. We got 15 more days that we could catch crabs up there that we didn't have.
Yeah, I can tell you the days that we lost in Lynnhaven by closing early is a bad thing for us. Because, again, I'll say it, we don't have a place to go. You know, and I just, you know, it to me, and I'm using my memory here, but I think the charts, the graphs that Mr. Rom Lissus showed years ago, the large quantity of crabs weren't down in the Lynnhaven area until June 1st. Is that correct? Do you recollect any of that, Rom? Does that sound about right?
Yeah.
So really, you know, by
it depends
by,
on the year, right? It depends on water.
Right. It all depends on weather. But to me, I mean, it's like we're not, by taking us out of that area, I mean, we're really not catching any more crabs. I mean, the crabs, according to statistics, aren't there.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I just have a bad taste in my mouth about this whole closure in that area. You know, I think that we need to be fair and equal throughout the bay, and I just don't see it. It's not fair and equal. And I'd like to see basically, you know, to be honest, I'd like to see it go back to June 1st for the whole bay, not just, you know, one specific area. That's how I feel about it.
Does anybody else have anything to add into that?
You know, I think we wrestled with the northern part of the sanctuary for years because of the water temp things, and I understand Mark's concerns that they don't have areas that they can fish once it closes down there. I think in general, and as you said, the guys that fish in the northern end, whether they're on Tangier or on the western shore, simply don't get crabs up there in those waters and until later in the year. And so I think it's a good example of trying to at least make it fair in terms of geographically throughout the area. Is it perfect? No, it's not perfect. But it's at least an effort, I think, in that sense, to try to bring a little more parity to the lower bay versus the upper bay in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the commission felt the same way. I mean, this was a long-standing issue for the commission, you know, going back to 2008 when, you know, it was nothing but restrictions bearing down on this fishery, and really the only loosening of those restrictions that have been done since then were those late season extensions where we had the potting season opened in November and even into December, where, you know, we the commission was hearing from people up north saying that's only benefiting the guys down south.
Correct. Yeah.
I think they felt like this was a long-standing issue. And what we came up with those three areas and those closure dates was really stretching, you know, where we needed to be, because we're always working back to what we have in place from 2008. So any modifications to regulations are really, there's got to be a trade-off, you know, to keep those conservation measures and working towards having that spawning stock. So working with Rahm and staff, you know, this is really the most give and take we could for having this. In other words, as we mentioned back then, you know, June 1 closure for everybody just doesn't get us there with the savings for female stock.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think, too, in general, one of the things, and I don't think we ended up with the data to support this, but I think a number of people were interested in looking more at a narrower sanctuary that maybe ran longer time-wise, but allowed people to fish parts of the bay and kind of reduce the constriction you guys have in the lower bay, but also give those guys up in Tangier and the guys on the western shore some areas to work out in the bay. You know, generally, Rahm, we're at about the 15-foot contour now, right? In that kind of the general 15 or
30.
About now, we're
closer to the
20. Okay. So, and I don't think we ended up with enough data to make a decision there, and this is kind of what was voted on. So, you know, if we've got some time, I think if we could look at some of those more specific options, with, like, say, maybe a narrower corridor but a longer duration, I think that would be good for the group to look at.
Mm-hmm. Anybody have any thoughts on that?
I think it should be narrowed up some. I mean, it's a lot of that bay right there. It's in the sanctuary.
Looks like it to me.
I mean, that's an awful lot.
Ms. Shemina, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of discussion on the item, and, you know, it was, I think, where we ended up last time and why we walked away from it was the feeling that there was the core area wasn't enough of a trade-off to consider having an exceptionally long closure. We couldn't get, there wasn't that much area opened up to say it would be worth the extended closures. You know, as Rahm had said, if he had some very specific areas to look at, he could work up the numbers on where that would put us. And really, in the end, that led to us just saying maybe we spend an entire meeting, maybe we spend an entire 3 or 4 hours just talking about the sanctuary areas.
Yeah, I mean, I think it would be worthwhile for us to maybe do the table in the round.
For something like that, yeah.
And bring a chart, and maybe at least we could come to consensus on two, maybe three options for Rahm to look at using navigational buoys and things like that. You know, what I remember us ended up with was somewhat of an ill-defined, and that's not saying bad about anyone, it just was an ill-defined narrowing of it. And I think what we need to do is to sit down and say, look, you know, because generally what we have now for enforcement purposes are areas that are defined by navigational buoys in some way, shape, or form, and look at a different set of buoys that are narrowed down and see if that's something that we can feed that info to Rahm and then get some calculations on.
Rahm, what do you think about that? Is that doable?
What I would need, you know, it's the same thing we discussed earlier, right. I would need to have something. Alternatives that are desired, and then we can look at that.
Mm-hmm.
The problem before was like, okay, go ahead, let's narrow the sanctuary, but it's like, okay, how much, well, how much time, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
I think there is definitely value in trying to narrow it with the addition of having some areas that are closed year-round. I mean, I think that was one of the things that the main thing we were talking about.
But we were also talking about possibly doing something for the lower southern shore, which the VMRC has no control over. The General Assembly does. So I think that's an issue.
The
lower historical sanctuary?
The other cutout that we had talked about, that we had actually kind of discussed coordinates on what would define that.
That's you're talking about historical sanctuary, right. the older
I mean,
one.
What something that Mark mentioned earlier was, you know, there's shoreline open for most of this, except down through here and then down through here. So one thing we had talked about tonight was a cutout here, but we have also had discussions about, you know, some cutout across here that would allow pods to be set.
Correct.
With this sanctuary still in place, and that would have to be done through.
Act of General Assembly.
Correct.
That's why that was tabled, just because we thought it was going to be a long process, but this might be the time to consider doing that.
You know, my concerns about that is, you know, okay, General Assembly is going to go, okay, yeah, you can change it, and then somehow it gets misconstrued, and next thing you know, down in Lynn Haven, that's closed year-round, and we don't have any place to go. That's my only concern. That's, you know.
The law of unintended consequences.
Correct.
Is what you're saying.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and then we'll be in a worse situation than we are now.
Mark, from a space standpoint, is drawing that parallel line that we've talked about.
Right.
Is that equal to you, or maybe even better than trying to carve out an exemption in the ocean?
You know, I mean, the ocean. You, when you go down there, you better expect to lose your whole rig.
Right.
I mean, that's what happens overnight. And the crappots are expensive now. In the bay, that you don't have that problem.
Right.
Your crappots just don't disappear.
Right.
You know. I mean, yeah, it would be better for us to stay in the bay. But the reality of it is, I mean, we need something, period, plain and simple. We need to have some place to go.
You know, one of the other discussion items that followed along with that was taking that number two here with a cutout and
right.
Really a discussion of having that as a year-round sanctuary. That's something that one of the longstanding members, Pete Nixon, has mentioned a few times.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he has mentioned that. So where do we need to go from here to... begin sort of putting some flesh on the bone, so to speak.
Yeah, that I think probably that would be have us do a meeting in the round. We'll bring out basically working tables out here, and just have the committee sit down. For one meeting, you know, that strictly on, what are by coordinates, as Chris said, and actually drawn out, like, what would be some of the best places to work that we can still say we're meeting the, you know, the savings.
Okay. And then, so thus, if we were going to do that, when would be our first opportunity to do so? I don't mean to put you on the spot.
I mean, we can get the, I would think, you know, we can get the committee together next month, whether or not, we can get that with the calculated savings turned around into a commission meeting prior to next season.
I mean, it doesn't hurt for us to go ahead and do a meeting next month or maybe even early November.
Yeah.
At least get the coordinates drawn up, and maybe we can at least come to consensus on two or three options, and then, you know, go from there. I mean, I don't foresee that part as the hard part. I foresee the hard part being the data analysis from Ron's point of view, and then what is the the trade-off. Is it, do we want to keep it there?
Dr. Lipschitz, is there a bottleneck or a way for data to be collected or manipulated any easier? You mentioned the buoys would give us points but more easily. Are there any other things that make...
Basically, it's just knowing what is preferred, whatever alternative. I mean, at this point, I feel pretty comfortable about the management and what's there. So now there's the opportunity to sort of change things to maybe better fit the fishery, to maximize the fishery out of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that it would be good to have alternatives that we can then assess and basically say, okay, this is no net loss.
Okay. All right. So.
And in fact, I just want to say that this is probably a good time to do it. I think if the opportunity is there because I see the population recovering, coming back from the 2012 drop, which I really believe wasn't right from. We're actually analyzing that.
Really?
So right now, I don't think there's going to be a fear that or backlash.
Mm-hmm. The fishery stable enough to begin to analyze how to.
We're seeing that it's recovering back to the 2009-10. We're seeing good numbers for the adults. We'll see if the juveniles. The fishery seems to be doing relatively well. So the good time to look at the economics.
Yeah. All right. So if we were going to do that, Mr. Cimino, should we begin to think about a date? Would that be next meeting or the November meeting?
Yeah, well, I think you know, we can send out some October dates. Okay. See how that works for everybody. And then take it from there if we got to move into November. But I think we could probably get that part in, you know, at least the committee meeting in October to... And I think, you know, we have sat down with this, so we've all got some ideas, and we know some of the historic areas that, you know, when we added all this in 07 and 08, that the areas that were really lost that people would probably like to see back. So.
If I could add one
yes,
other
sir.
Thing, this is also, you know, I think it was 2 years ago now, we basically replaced Jim Kirkley, who was our marine resource economist, and that's Andy Michel is here, and he's really eager to get into world. We've had a few different discussions, and so it might be a good opportunity now to have him come and be present in the discussion and go over some things, how he might make suggestions to sort of maximize the economics of the fishery. I know he's interested in doing that, so you might want to just...
I would think it would be a... Does that sound all right to everybody?
Mm-hmm.
Let's see if we can include him in our discussions whenever we do have the meeting.
Sounds good. I think that's, you know, we had the industry panel,
right.
Something, you know, we had a former NOAA economist, John Ward, sit in on a lot of the meetings. And it's one of the things that really, with all the data that we collect for management,
right.
We don't do it in a way that an economist really needs it. It's there. You know, the industry knows it. They can feed that information to someone like Andrew. I think that would be a good thing. And, you know, to be here and have those discussions. Really, I think more than anything, for just a give and take, for them to hear what kind of stuff he needs. And, you know, and what that would be to get that kind of stuff together. Because we send out requests, surveys. I'm sure you guys get calls or mailings from us asking, you know, like just trying to get some idea of what the prices are quarterly and that kind of stuff. But it's kind of the way the market changes so quickly, and, you know, we don't send out stuff that often. We're we're not factoring in all the cost that's going in, you know, so that's the kind of stuff.
No, I think it's a great idea. All right. So then let's move to effort control measures.
Yeah. So overall, one of the things that we bring up but have not done anything, made any recommendations on, is the waiting list that came about where individuals that had, this was during 2008, the crisis of 2008, any individuals that didn't report any harvest, any activity in the blue crab fishery between 2004 and 2007 ended up on this waiting list. And so I have a breakdown of the 515 individuals that had their hard pot license put on the waiting list, and there were 332 that ended up on the waiting list from the Peeler fishery. And I just wanted to show you, although nobody's made any decisions on that, there has been attrition. You know, we're down to 253 licensees that are still on the waiting list. It's been cut considerably, so that, you know, there's 800 there, and we're down to 250.
Mm-hmm.
Taking no action.
Out of the 253 licenses on there, how many of them are considered full-time commercial fishermen, do you know?
No, I haven't looked.
I'm just kind of curious if there's, I know gill netters and stuff like that used to crab.
Yeah.
I was just wondering if there's, you know, individuals that just, that's the only thing that they did.
Yeah, I can look.
I would say for the next meeting, too, it would be interesting, Joe, if we could get numbers for 1, 2, and 3. How you know,
oh, how many went out?
How many went out due to no commercial versus bought back in versus granted exception?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Well, the ones that were granted an exception, that one's easy.
Yeah.
But whether or not they came back through a transfer or just got out of commercial fishing
together. And that may be it. I mean, three is probably, I guess in some ways, if I feel if they were granted an exception by the commission, then they probably really never were on the waiting list in some
some
ways. So we're
yeah. And you know, actually I can get at it pretty easily because what I'll just look to see who isn't there, and then by process of elimination I'll find the transfers and who got back in five. So I don't know if this committee is interested, if there's any opinions on the waiting list, if, you know, if there's any thoughts on that. Or
any thoughts on the waiting list? Or?
Because it is a tough number. It is. It was kind of an unprecedented move for the commission, I think.
I mean, generally, I think that the reason the guys that are in the fishery now are in the fishery and didn't put on the waiting list is because they were using their licenses, you know,
right,
when this came down. And I think, although it's tough, this was at least a way to bring to protect the guys who were in it from those folks who weren't and didn't allow for latent effort. I'm really interested in number two on this to see how many people that we did originally put on the waiting list were able to buy. To buy back in, because
yeah.
Obviously there are some to gauge the interest about who's actually going
right.
into the fishery.
Yeah, because I, you know, a lot of that attrition is just older individuals that,
mm-hmm.
you know, that are a lot of them really no longer with us, and others that you know couldn't possibly get back into commercial fishing. I think a lot of the interest for those individuals is the fact that as of really a limited entry fishery by year, these licenses have value. It's just a matter of those families looking to see that.
Can you determine at all what kind of value a license has?
Well, we don't necessarily get involved with it, but we do allow kind of a classified ad type stuff to go on our website.
Right.
And so we do see some of those individuals that are listing their licenses for sale and some that are looking for licenses. I think some of the committee members probably got an idea of what the different rigs go for, too. So.
Can you give me any sense of what rigs go for? Say, for instance, the 425?
No, I haven't looked recently, but I don't know.
They're none. You can't buy them. They're hard to come by. You can't buy a 425.
You can't buy one.
You can buy some 300s, stuff like that, but I mean.
And a 300 would be worth how much?
It's hard to say. Just what the person wants. I mean, you know, sometimes you find a deal, sometimes you don't.
Uh-huh. So it is. I find it interesting. I mean, if the fishery is a valuable fishery, the license has got to be worth something.
Yeah. What's that?
You want me to go look it up?
I was hoping I could actually just bring it up right here, but you know, and one of the other reasons why I think this is so difficult is when the Blue Crab panel was looking at long term for this fishery, they talked about getting young people in. You know, they asked me what was the average age of a crab. You know, that becomes a big challenge for us is how do we bring in new people when we have, 250 people that have been waiting to get back in since 2008? How do you move, younger people around them?
But I would say I kind of believe, like Chris, I don't think there's a get back in. I don't
right.
know. I mean, you all can tell me if I'm wrong. I think people who weren't fishing 2004 through 2007 really weren't crabbers. They were kind of part-time.
Right.
Every once in a while kind of people.
Well, or there was another fishery that you can make more money at, like gill netting at
right.
that time. I know
right.
for some individuals, they went croaker fishing
right.
because they made more money at it.
Yes.
Now that that's croaker fishing is basically dying, the fish are on decline.
Right.
They're not making any money.
Yeah.
And those are the people that, I'm concerned about that are full-time fishermen that want to crab now, but they can't.
Uh-huh.
And they're on the waiting list.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Yeah.
There you go. Well, here's a 210 for 5,000.
Yeah.
127 for 8,500.
Yeah, I think they're kind of all over the place.
85 pot.
Yeah. What's 85?
85 is 4,000.
They might not necessarily be all that serious about doing it, but if somebody was willing to pay it, they just pick their price for getting out.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Okay.
I think some of these at least are, or there's others that are looking to move the license.
Looks like peeler pot licenses, as you would expect, are a little bit higher. Looks like around 7,000, 8,000 for a 210.
That's an 85 pot, 6,000.
Yeah.
That was a full.
Who's trading? Wants to trade?
6,000.
That's already gotten sold.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's the only way we have any, we don't really get involved with this kind of activity.
Yeah, well, it's good to see that, in some regard, good to see that the license are worth something. The fisheries has enough. But I see what you're saying, Mark. I mean, this is one of the issues that, I think for the whole Bay is that, you have people who to have a diversified portfolio of what they're doing, and they might be conkings one year, and then they might go to crab, and they might go to gill. It's a little bit of, you see that a lot, at least on the Eastern Shore. I'm not sure how that plays out on the Western Shore, but I suspect the same.
Yeah, since I'm the one that always updates this, I've been the one just really, especially since I was providing this to the panel the last couple of years, I was saying that by doing nothing, even our inaction is, something is still happening, even though we haven't made any decisions. I guess that's not surprising, but a lot of the individuals that wanted to crab did come, got back in. one other item I have for you on effort control, and, you know, this is a discussion item people are welcome to bring up whatever they like, is the use of crab agents. This is something that we did take action on last year. This committee was shown how many individuals have been applying for it, and in the process of that, we pointed out that the number of active agents is, well, the number of requests and the number of active agents has been climbing. We noted that the you know, the most ever was this past year at 124, so it was a CMAQ recommendation to just cap it at 125, and we brought that before the commission in February this year, and they did just that. So now there is a maximum of 125 individuals in the fishery that can get an agent to work for.
Okay. Would you mind elaborating on why y'all did that?
I think in general, we're concerned that people are gaming the system by working agents. I think in general, there was concern that, you know, people with land jobs were basically renting their licenses out, and that therefore you had people involved in the fishery who really didn't need to be involved in the fishery, and they were taken away from the full-time waterman. I think there were also concerns raised by members that the agents don't have as much invested in the fishery,
right?
So you end up with more conflicts between the various watermen in some cases because the agents are less invested.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Just like I say, seem to be more there. And I think there was fairness of one person, one boat, one license,
right,
for folks.
Yeah, and you know, I know, again, Pete's not here, but this is one that he would always bring up. You know, he would note that he was instrumental in bringing about a commercial car, and in that process, they talked about the use of agents. There are going to be times where you can't go out and get your gear, but your gear is out there, so they should be able to go and get it. That was the concept of what an agent was originally.
That's
really
what it's supposed to be for.
Right.
That was what an agent
was. In other words, if I was the
got
sick,
right,
I could give somebody my card, and they could be my agent to get my stuff up,
yeah,
or to fix my stuff until I got better.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it, and it kind of went away.
You know, since we've asked folks, or since we've, this is the only fishery that we require documentation of aging. You know, it's clear from that that this is a business plan.
Sure.
That's how it's going.
Mm-hmm. And that wasn't its original intent.
That was not the original intent.
Well, and you know, and that's a committee discussion. That's not something that, you know, in a sense that they may be otherwise inactive licenses, it's hard to say. You know, from a resource, we're not saying that there's too many people in because of it or out because of it. So it's just more of a consideration on what do you think an agent should be.
Mm-hmm. Mark?
I got a question. Staff's opinion, I mean, are there actually too many participants in the blue crab fishery or not with the number of licenses out today?
You know, it's hard to say. We really don't have a lot to go on. I think the work that Jim Kirkley did on trying to define what is overcapacity for this fishery was some of the most telling.
It's probably a lot that didn't even being used.
Mm-hmm. Right. But I think there are how many active licenses right now? 700? 500? 700?
Nope. The hard pot fishery is about 700.
Okay, and probably out of the 700, probably 400 or 500 are being used, if that much.
Well, I'm not sure. But when I say active, I mean
okay, know, actually using. Right. Okay, so I'm sorry. Maybe there's 1,200 or something like
there's
that.
There's 1,200.
Okay.
There's 1,200 eligible.
Right. It's somewhere around 1,200. So if we've got a banner year this year, per se, mm-hmm. and next year you have a lot more people jump into it, I mean, there's going to be a problem, is how I look at it, based on the fact that we don't have the capability to handle those crabs if they do come off.
In some ways, you, all the folks with the commercial ties tonight kind of grumbled about the price. I mean, are we, no, even this year, are we a little
that's
bit?
That's where we're at now. There's so many crabs, right. We're not getting anything for them.
Right.
They're worthless. And I said all along, everybody's fighting to bring the crabs back. And I said, what are you going to do with them when they get here?
Right.
There's
no
picking houses no more.
And we knew that.
You know, even me, as small as my picking house was, I had 20 pickers. I'm down to three.
Right.
You know? I mean, you got all these Casey's gone, you know? There's no picking houses for it. And keep saying the sanctuary to catch more females. I'm like, what good is it if you catch them? You could open them up.
Yeah.
You can't give them away. I mean, you're going to have to leave them there even if you catch them. You know, it's going to get to the point now, if you don't have market, they want to give you $10 a bushel for them. What good is that? That doesn't even pay for your fuel, your bait or anything, you know? The more crabs that y'all bringing in, the more worthless they are. And there's just nothing we can do with them. It's not like before when you had, you know, picking houses after picking houses. I mean, you know, you had picking houses with 200-300 pack pickers. Everybody's down to 20 crab pickers.
If you guys are interested, we could recirculate, you know, because it's been a few years now. We can recirculate that report. And I think that is important because it when you talk about this as a fishery, it goes beyond, you know, the crab resource and,
right.
and us staying under target for exploitation. It goes to capacity and how are you doing this for...
What I'm worried about is people coming in back, you know, back in this April when they can get a lot of money for their crabs and the market's going to be flooded and then, you know, we're down to $10 in the spring of the year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's when I make my money.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen that in my time here. I've seen those big springs where when the commission didn't even have crab on the agenda, you know, individuals from the fishery coming up and saying, you need something more than just or more restricted than the 51
bushels.
51.
But I think, at least based on the folks I've talked to, we weren't 51. We were lower than that, obviously, now, this past
right.
year. I think most folks I talk to agree that the bushel limits we have in place have helped the market keep from being flooded.
I don't know about that.
Yeah. Like you said, if they start... If you've got those other 1,200 people, the other 500 are not coming in next year, even if, you know.
Even with those limits.
Yeah.
yeah. Also, you've got another 500 people coming in to catch the limit. There's, you know.
I got a question, probably a little bit off. What year did we lose the pots, like a 500 pot?
2000.
Get reduced down to 425. And
2008. 2008.
Yeah.
It was in 08?
That was it.
The same time that they took the license.
Hadn't there been a reduction in pots before that? A small reduction?
No, we took it in two waves.
Yeah.
We did, but I think we only... We did hard pots, I think, at one point. We did peeler pots at the other. And then we gave some hard pots back. But we didn't give any peeler pots back, I think is the – have to go back and look at that. But there were – you're right. There were two sets of reductions we took, but then I think we gave hard pots back.
Well, anything else on effort control? In some ways, I think you're right. Effort control is a part of economics, to be honest mm-hmm. with you. I mean, when you see pots start coming out of the water when the price goes down. Come up.
Well, I know this is probably impossible, but I would like to see where only watermen can work. I know so many people who have high-paying jobs, take their vacation time and crab, you know, and they've got their health insurance and their paid leave. And I mean, I think there should be some type of rule where you have to, like, 75% of your income or something should come from the water in order for you to even possess a waterman's card. I mean, I know so many people have got waterman's cards. Working at the shipyard, you know, they're getting their paycheck every week, and they're just doing it more for you know, extra money, a bonus fund, you know. And they, of course, they do. They take their time when the price is high and they can make their money and hit and run, and then they go back to their paying job. I mean, I think if you don't get your money from the water, you should leave it to the waterman. You know, I know it sounds easy for me because that's what we do, and it's, I'm sure the other people go, it's not fair, but, you know, they got their paycheck. They got their income and their holiday pay and health insurance, and yet they want to come in and take our money from us. You know, they're hurting us by coming in. I think, and if you want a waterman's card, I think you should be a waterman. I mean, I understand maybe it was a couple months out of the year in the winter time that you have to do construction or something, or but I think it should be for the waterman to work.
Yeah, you're certainly not the first person to suggest it, and you know, it was something that was looked at here as well. I mean, when we presented the commission with all the potential cuts, we spent a lot of time looking at, you know, how many days an individual worked, and that really became one of kind of the definitions of full time for this fishery. I think it was at the, you know, at least 100-day mark. I think it was. It was one of the discussions that ended up happening here, but it's brought up with our you know, with our other committees and our other species as well. We went to a limited entry permit for spiny dogfish, and there's also a reciprocating federal permit for that. It's been pointed out several times that the feds do kind of define what that full time is, and it's something like it's a income threshold. You know.
Well, I mean, I know people that have rock permits and don't even own a boat or a net. You know, I mean, they don't even own a boat, and all they do is just money for. I mean, of course, we're the fools that do all the work for them, and we only get a small part of it. But, you know, it's like, why do they got a fish? They don't even own a boat, and they got a waterman's card and get rock permits and don't even have a net. You know,
I can sort of sympathize with your frustration. I think it's something long term we're going to have to address, because I don't see, say, for instance, with crab, I don't see picking houses coming back.
They're not coming back. I'd sell mine today if I could find a fool.
Come on. But, I mean, no, I think it's long-term. You ever control, I think it's something we're going to have to deal with, because if we want to have crabs coming out of the bay in a sustainable fishery, we've got to make it, in fact, sustainable.
You're right. Those are long-term discussions. You know, and it gets back to how do you get young people into this, too, and you know, some of the things that other states...
You don't get too many young ones in it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, they're only opening up these permits.
Too many limits on it.
Do apprenticeships and stuff like that. So you start to get into that. The only new entrants are going to be people that are dedicated to this, that are already out on the boat for, you know, a certain number of days for the last few years before they can...
I don't know how a young person could...
possibly afford
it. Out of high school, I mean, to afford a $200,000 boat with a rig and license, I mean, there's no young person that's got $200,000 going, oh, I think I'm going to invest it into the seafood business.
And then not knowing how long you can work or what you can do.
I mean, I have a 21-year-old son, and I refuse to let him work on the water. I mean, he's in college now, and he works in the summertime. And that's enough. He said, this year, thank God I'm going back to college. So.
I'm surprised the commission ain't came up with a picture ID for commercial watermen. I can go across the bay, and I can give somebody my card, and they can ask them, and the inspectors don't have a clue who they are.
Well...
Reason they know us.
Yeah.
So we ain't got
no problem. Yeah, but if you go across the bay, I've been across the bay, and they didn't know me from Adam.
Right.
I could have took anybody's card and used it.
Well, is there, under effort control, is there anything else that we, I mean, all these things are valid. I don't, you know, I don't know where you begin to get a foothold to start up the hill.
From staff's perspective, these two things are, you know, we can let them sit as they are right now. If people have ideas or thoughts or ways to at least discuss moving forward, certainly willing to consider if there's things we want to work up. Chris had some stuff that I'll try and get out to the committee, some more information on what happened specific, flesh out what happened with individuals within the waiting list. But if there's anything else that people want to see.
All right. Well, should we move on? I think that the crabs are an important part of our economy, culture, part of a lot of people's livings, individuals. I hope we can keep some of the stuff in front of us that we talk about here now. Do we have sort of a bucket list of sort, or sort of not a bucket
really,
list,
a
holding tank?
These are three of the four that adjustments to the sanctuary that are bay-wide they feel are equitable. effort control, there are still those that have concerns about agents.
Right.
And like I said, that waiting list is always just sitting there. Pot tagging, buoy tagging is a way to stop people sitting way past their pot limits out there. and then the sponging.
Yeah, I was going to ask a question. We, in 2008, I guess we did something with call rings and savings and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
We were calculating we were going to get X amount savings
yeah.
with call rings. Have y'all looked into that again? Because the average size of the blue crab in Chesapeake Bay has, decreased, the females.
I've noticed that, too.
So, my thinking behind this is, okay, we're getting a greater savings from our call rings than we first thought. Does that sound about right to you, or?
Well, what we found, we did this analysis some years ago.
Right.
That the average size of females had not at that time been genetically reduced. That's what we found is when we looked at the female size of Maryland waters, they remained the same size, much larger than Virginia. What happened in Virginia, it did decline, its abundance declined, and it looks like the explanation small females were getting out as opposed to the colors, as opposed to large ones. So by the time females came out from Maryland, they were the larger ones were getting culled out. And then we ended up with the smaller females.
Right.
So the concern back then for us was it genetic, because it's happened in fish and some other species. But we didn't get any indication that it was happening. And we'll say it's probably time to redo the analysis, and that'd be simple. Probably
Okay.
Sometime
early next year. Right. What I'm thinking is, okay, we're getting a larger savings based on the size of the crab. And I think you said basically the spawn's not really – it doesn't change by the size of the crab. Is that correct?
No, it does.
It does. What I'm getting at is we're getting greater savings on female crabs. Why couldn't we take a portion of that savings we're getting, possibly shift it to the sanctuary? You follow where I'm going with this? Use an increased savings on the cull ring to reduce the size of the sanctuary. If that's true.
What increased savings?
Well, if the crabs are smaller, more and more are escaping through your cull rings. For instance, I threw over pots this spring not knowing my cull rings were closed.
So you're saying make larger cull rings?
No, what I'm saying is keep things the way they are. We're getting a larger savings in crabs because they're crawling out of our cull rings and decrease the size of the sanctuary. If that is true, what I'm saying.
Yeah, I think my personal view on that is that I think we need to be careful about continuing sort of a long-term culling of the larger females because you could get to a point where they get smaller.
Right.
And so that's certainly genetic, and you don't want that.
No, it's already a bad thing.
The quality of product is much worse and so on.
But, I mean, we're already doing it. We're already culling the crabs. And I'm not saying increase the size of the call ring. What I'm saying is, okay, take that. You estimated there was a 10% savings back in 2008. it could possibly be a 15% savings now by allowing those crabs to escape. So you have an extra 5%.
I have to really think about it carefully. I personally like the sanctuary because it does allow the large females to persist and reproduce as opposed to just having small females reproduce.
Right. Just an idea. I mean, I don't want the small crabs to reproduce. I can tell you they have no market value whatsoever. None. But, you know, if
Effort control, we finished with that. I think that Mrs. West's point about full-time watermen, I think something we need to continue to be cognizant of. And if we can move forward a little bit, I agree that a person who has a good paying job and then wants to hit the high points of the marketplace when it suits them, take a vacation day when the crabs are fetching a good price, and doesn't help the industry in a long-term fashion.
Yeah, it's... That might actually be something, again, to talk about with an economist. It's, as I mentioned, as far as what we collect, as VMRC staff, we can't present to you what a person's overall income is. You know, so to go that route, I think that would be an interesting discussion.
You could at least do seafood harvest.
Yeah.
I mean, because someone may not be harvesting a lot of crabs, but they may be in some other fishery,
we need
to give them the flexibility to move around.
Days worked, it was days worked.
Fisheries, right.
Yeah. And crabbing and everything. We put it together like that. Hmm. We even worked that up for them.
Yeah.
And in fact, those are two fisheries that had interplays. Crabfish fishery. Really pushing blue cat. I said blue cat about four times at FMAC trying to get people to realize that should be our newest winter fishery.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. We'll move on then. New business. Crab pot buoy tagging. Ms. Hall.
Have Ida here? Yeah. Come on up. I'll pass you that one.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you very much. I don't know if I can stand here or not because I'm so sure.
Stand around.
Let's stand around here somewhere.
That's not a bus.
Anyway,
you'll be enough. And this is just to take a quick look at and see kind of what they're doing as far as accountability for losses. They have a form
assigned
for loss tag.
There's four. There's four.
Yeah, go with that. All right, well, I've been on the Potomac River Fisheries Commission since 2002. So back in September of 2011, the commission approved the crab pot buoy ID tagging program, and it was passed. There are eight commissioners, four from Virginia and four from Maryland. It was passed 6-2. It became effective on April the 1st of 2012. And the main reason for doing this was the idea of having a buoy tagging program was to maintain the compliance with effort controls in the fishery and to be able to accurately account for these controls. Otherwise, even with the female-only bushel limits that we have recently adopted, the Potomac River Commission could still issue a 285 pot license or any of their three categories of licenses. And in the absence of a pot or buoy ID program, the crabber could still be fishing well over the number. There'd be no way to know who was putting out what pot was it's tagged, and then the enforcement officer could identify the pot. because the Tampa River Commission had heard unconfirmed reports of abusive crab pot limits. So marking the crab pots would facilitate enforcement of crab pot license limits. And the cost of these crab pot tagging program is completely funded by the crabbers themselves. And I have given you, it's supposed to be two columns. The column on the left was the cost of what was collected and what the commission paid out in 2012. So the commission actually came out ahead in that, as well as last year in 2014. Data from this year isn't complete, so that's why I showed you a comparison between 2012 and 2014. The commission offers the crabbers two different ways to mark their pots. They have decals that can be attached directly to the crab pot buoy, and I had intended to bring one because they occasionally wash up on the beach back in my house, and so I had the tag I had. And then there is a removable tag, there's the decals that attach to the buoy, and then a removable tag. And actually, it seems that the decals have been used more frequently. I think there was concern with the crabbers when they went to power wash their buoys and pots and stuff that the tags might get washed off. But they have an option of replacement of the removable tags. And I think it's interesting to note that the first year there were 282 replacement tags for the entire year, and last year it was almost 100 less, or 2 years ago, yeah, last year.
Mm-hmm.
The Potomac River Commission licenses, crab pot licenses, are limited entry. There are three categories, the 300, 400, and 500 pot license, and with the 5% reduction that the potters took as part of their reduction and effort, that they're reduced to the three to 285, 380, and 475 pots. And no more than one crab pot license can be issued to any person and or a single boat. And there are no agents in the Potomac River. And a crabber must renew or purchase in December of the preceding year or by January the 31st of the year they plan to crab. They do have an option to renew as late as April the 30th, but they would pay a late fee. And if they fail to renew then, they lose their license. We put a cap. We're trying to reduce the number of licenses in Potomac to no more than 400. So when the crabber comes in to renew his license, his or her license, the staff would ask if they want to purchase tags or decals under the presumption that they would be an active crabber. So if they are active, then they would pay the $50 crab pot ID fee per license. And they would receive either the removable tags or the decals by March the 15th. And the Potomac River crab season starts April 1st. If they decline to purchase tags or decals, then the staff at that time the staff would list them as inactive. If they are inactive, but then they decide later on they want to become active, then they are required to contact the commission office, pay the $50 fee for the tags or decals. It has to be 45 days before they plan to crab to assure that they would get the decals in time. And actually, if they wait, that they're only going to get the decals. And I think there has been problems with the company printing the smaller quantities of decals. And then each crab pot buoy would have one PRFC-issued crab pot tag or decal attached and displayed in a manner that's clearly visible on the surface of the water. In the Potomac, they also have another option to put out crab pots. They have what they call long lines. And I don't know for certain, but I think this was created because for areas where there's a lot of boat traffic.
The minimum number of lines are connected to this
where there's a lot of heavy boat traffic in the Potomac. I think this is why this came about, to reduce the number of buoys. And the long line is essentially a method of fishing crab pots where individual pots are attached, where you have a series of pots on a single line. And at each end, it's marked with a spar buoy, and you have to have on there how many pots. You can have a line for 15 or up to 15 or up to 30. And you're required to fix under the buoy tagging program, you would be required to fix either 15 or 30 of the decals on the buoy. And if the crabber was running a long line with, let's say, 17 pots, he would have to actually go up to the 30 pot ID decals. He would affix them to the spar buoy. But that's just something that the Potomac River has. And the replacement for ID tags or decals, each crabber is allowed the original number of crab pot tags or decals originally issued plus 5%. And the way the commission does it, they go ahead and grant either the 300, 400, 500, 100 pot license would get that number. They rounded up. I think I did it with the 285 pots, and it would actually be 299 with the 5%, but they go ahead and round it up to 300 and so forth. You're also allowed an additional 5% in excess of the original number issued, but they have to purchase $1 each up to additional. And if they need any other replacements, then they have to be accompanied with an incident report on form supplied by the commission, like I showed you, and then that would go before the commission to decide whether or not to refuse or grant the request. And since the program has started, we have not had to deal with this so far. There is a provision for a river-wide or defined area weather event, and the commission could suspend the ID tagging program for a period of time or an area as it decides. And this has not so far happened in the river yet. And I had asked our Executive Secretary, Marty Geary, some questions, because I've really not heard too much about the success of the program, so I guess no news was good news, because and I know there's a concern to the VMRC as to, you know, management time and expense to handle such a program. And the comments in here, Marty had said that really time was not intrusive to the other duties. The cost was reasonable, and the actual performance of the decals and tags have been good to excellent. You know, there were some problems, I think, initially with some ink fading and the condition of the tags maybe not being thick enough for the decals. And they did a lot of research into the materials before the program was implemented. And law enforcement, as you might imagine, is extremely supportive. They've actually told the commission repeatedly that the ID program is enforceable and makes their job easier while ensuring compliance within the management framework. And there have been very minimal complaints or problems from the crabbers, although there were none that supported the introduction of this program back in 2011. And no one has stood up and demanded that we abolish the program. And even though we've adopted the female bushel limits, there's no discussion or thoughts to, you know, to abolishing the program now. And, you know, Marty had said that, you know, he's very pleased with the program, and that Maryland managers have said they wish they had the program. You know, hopefully this might spread to other jurisdictions. And, you know, the staff at the PRC hasn't had any complaints. And the Crabbers, you know, they aren't really excited about the idea of spending time to put the decals or tags on the buoys. But they do it, and, you know, they come up with unique ways to streamline the application. And it looks like that they actually prefer the decals to the removable tags. The Potomac River Commission has all the regulations on their website, which we just renovated the whole thing, and it should be in place today. So, you know, if you want to read up on it, there's something.
Any questions of Ms. Hall?
You indicated that they actually like the decal better than the tag. That's surprising.
This was a comment from Marty Geary, the executive secretary of the commission, made. And I mean, you can look at the expense. I mean, the cost. I didn't have time. I just got this information today from him. I don't know if there is a big difference in the cost of decals or the tags. You know, with the prices. But, I mean, there's certainly more money. There are more decals, it appears, that are being purchased than the removable tags. And I'm sorry I don't have them here to show you. I probably messed up the system. They probably have to order them.
Any other questions?
It's something to think about. I was asked to provide this information.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I have one or two more questions, if I could. Why did law enforcement, why did they in particular like it?
I think when there were crabbers that would complain that, you know, this guy over here, he's got a 285-pot license, but I know he's got it at 500 pots. Well, they can't do anything about it. They can't, I mean, because unless every buoy has a tag or decal, one or the other on it, and you're only allowed, whatever your license is, you get that number of tags plus the 5% replacement. So you're only going to have, you know, that 5% additional. So you can't have 300 or 500 more pots than allowed.
Right.
So that helped them with their job. I mean, they're, you know, they want to try and, you know, work with the commission to help us manage the effort. So I think that was it. Sorry to run in.
That's okay.
Them to speak for themselves.
Okay. So just that simple fact that's similar to other tags, it's what's there is all you can have, essentially.
Exactly. I mean,
mm-hmm.
It restricts you. It protects the crab potter, really. I mean,
yeah.
I know. I was one of the two that initially did not support it, and I didn't because I was concerned that there weren't. I mean, I was off it when I was fishing 100 pots. One weekend, I lost 10, and so I'm thinking, you know, 5% just didn't sound like enough.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my reason for not going with it, but. You know, I really haven't heard that much complaint from the watermen there, and they seem to be, you know, it does protect them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if they're playing by the rules, so is the other person.
Right. Well, you can constantly hear about people fishing way too many pots.
Right.
I mean,
it's
constant. Any other comments, questions? Great. Well, thank you. I appreciate all this. This is great. Good job.
Well, Marty was telling me I screwed up on a couple of today. some of it. But like I said, the actual regulations are online on the commission website.
Great. Well, thank you for your presentation and the write-up. My goodness. Any comments? Anybody? Is this our future?
I hope not. I'm going to vote no with y'all vote.
Now, why is that?
I'm just so tired of being regulated. I'm so tired of having to pay more money for more, call rings.
It looks like they made a profit on these tags, too.
Yeah. That's the first thing I said. Making more money off of them. It's just, I don't know.
So what did y'all do with that extra money? Did y'all give it back to the waterman? Knock the cost off? Or?
Well, some of the money that they do pay, not in this, but their commercial registration license fee, that money is going towards this restoration of oyster grounds in the Potomac River. So they are actually getting something back.
Yeah, that's something.
Dr. Lipschitz.
One of the trade-offs is the benefits of having the tax is that if you actually get a control of effort, well, first of all, we can manage the fishery better. But if you control effort, there's a possibility that with hot reductions and that would come from that you actually would have to spend less fuel, put out fewer pots, and so on. All you're doing is splitting up the pie in smaller and smaller and smaller sections. And for a crabber, of course, that means fishing more pots means more fuel, more time, more pots. So I think the crabbers would actually benefit over the long run with having this because you have a good handle and be able to enforce the effort controls. So you really think it would be really good to actually say pose it.
But if you're already on a limit, like I'm only allowed to catch 25 bushels, if I catch them in 100 pots or my 500 pot license, I mean, you're only going to, like right now the crabs are so plentiful, we're not even fishing our limits, So.
Well, that's what I'm saying. You don't have to, you'd be able to get the same number of crabs.
Yeah, it doesn't change anything. It's just, I look at it as more work. It's just more work and more money and more.
You had another point, too. It's another regulation. And
it's just another, another rule.
I'm unsupervised tonight. So
yeah,
I may veer into some personal opinions. But, we had separate staff meetings with a few commission members. It was the law enforcement subcommittee, and part of that was to address poaching in the striped bass fishery. And I got to a point where, after long discussions of how much more complicated we could make it, I had to point out that this is already like a 32-page regulation. It's incredibly complicated to explain this to somebody coming into this fishery. The vast majority of the individuals are, doing this legit, and they're jumping through more and more hoops, and it's more and more complicated for staff to deal with and for law enforcement to build a case against somebody. For the few that are bound and determined to already break a law.
Don't think it's that many.
We've had committee members say, look, you're going to put this in place, and they'll just go to the unmarked long lines,
Yeah.
And, there's other aspects of this. Not that I'm against it, and staff has always been supportive of at least pursuing the possibility of this, and we're not going to not do that. But it's a big fishery for us. For striped bass, we basically have a dedicated position that's really a revolving door, to be honest with you. In my 11 years here, we've had 7 people doing that job because it's a lot of work to deal with the striped bass tags and distributing and all that. And that's 500 people. We're talking about nearly 2,000 people that have crab pot licenses.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the other concerns that I've never heard anybody say that I have is that right now
we have a bushel limit. And that bushel limit was in part to address the fact that we know people were fishing too many pots.
Right.
We had 85 pot licenses that were reporting harvest.
Right.
It's absolutely impossible to do in 85 pots. But when we set those bushel limits, they also became vessel limits. So you could only have the number of the highest license holder on board. That doesn't say you can't, if you had two licensed crab pot fishermen on board, if you had a, you know, the 255 and the 85 pot license, that's not to say that all of those pots can't be set. There's nothing in law prohibiting that. There's nothing in law prohibiting them from fishing all those pots. But when it's said and done, at the end of the day, they're tied to, you know, to choose that one license category and fish that bushel limit. But I think there could be a perception that there's people fishing too many pots for what they're allowed. I think there could be some small amount of that. I don't doubt for a second that there's people simply fishing illegally out there. Mm-hmm. But that could be a new business model for people to say, hey, you're not using your pot license, get your tags. Let me set your pots out there, and I'll fish those along with mine.
Yeah, you make a point.
And so that's something I've never heard discussed, but it's...
There's ways around walls.
Yeah, it would be legal.
Yeah.
Day in and day out, people find ways.
And that's what's tough. I mean, that's what becomes so difficult. Is,
right.
Is we start to write these regulations to get more and more complicated. those guys. And in the process, how many other people are you hurting?
So I'll make a question to Ms. Hall. So as I understand it here, so in the Potomac, you have 352 crabbers then. So you said 352 sets of tags. So that's the number you're dealing with.
That was the number, and I'm not, to be perfectly honest, I'm not saying that, and I didn't get that clarified. That was when the AC Carpenter was the executive secretary, and that was the information in 2012. And Marty did not include that with the information.
Mm-hmm.
That might be how many come in each year and the rest kind of declare out, if you will, right?
Well,
do you think that?
Yeah, that could be it.
That was, so basically you can renew your license and come in, but what this isn't showing is that whether you were active or not. This is showing the active.
Right.
The ones that got the tags and decals. But there could have been 200 more that came in, paid their license fee so they can keep their license, but did not work that year.
Okay.
So that's not a real, that number that was in the 2012 data, the 352 tags or decals, that represents only those crabbers that actually worked that year. That does not really represent the total number of crab licenses.
Yeah, but still, it's a number that's not as vast as the state of Virginia number would be.
Well, and the area fished is, and that needs to be policed, isn't it?
Right.
Now, you know, I will say I don't think from a staff perspective there's much more for us to pursue. We really, especially right now, but we've been saying this since 2008, we don't think we can pull it off without a staff member. And we really think the only way to get funding for that staff member is through the cost of the tags.
Right.
So, you know, we've put out a number at about $180,000 a year that we would need to generate to make this whole program work.
Right.
And we still feel that that's true. So the tags, that would have to be paid for through the tags or a fee and the tags. Mm. And aside from that, you know, back in... 2009, when we went all the way to the commission with talking about this, we had done research what other states have done, and you know, we still have that information. But in that sense, I think the Potomac has what looks like a successful, simple system that you know, individuals are happy with, law enforcement's happy with, the decals, amazing. You know, it was a hard concept for me to believe that you can just peel off this little decal, put it on the buoy, and you're good for the year. But it seems like it's working. So as far as that goes, that, you know, I don't know how much more research we would need to be doing into what kind of system we would use once we moved forward. But
all right. Any comments or questions before we conclude the meeting? Mr. Cimino, anything that you want to add before we adjourn?
Nope, just I think we'll get together with Lynn and, you know, start talking some dates with you and Lynn, and then we'll send out some options to the whole committee and see what seems to be the best date in October.
Right.
And we'll be ready to get as specific as possible with a couple options for the sanctuary.
All right. Everybody agreeable to that? All right, so move to adjourn. Is somebody willing to make that motion?
Move to adjourn.
Yep, suck it.
Thank you.